This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to the Rerooted Podcast with Francesca Maxime, trauma-sensitive mindfulness meditation teacher and poet. Together, we'll take a closer look at approaches to transforming trauma with insights from psychology, neuroscience, spirituality, social justice, and the creative arts. Join Francesca and her guests for an exploration of our shared connection and how we can cultivate greater compassion for ourselves and for others. If you'd like to support Francesca and the Rerooted Podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Francesca.
Hey everyone, I'm Francesca Maxime, and welcome to this edition of the Rerooted Podcast here on Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network. At the time of this taping, it is August 11th, 2021, and here in the U.S., and specifically on Uncotog territory here in Long Island, New York, there really has been a resurgence of the variants of the COVID situation, and so we're sort of maybe perhaps thinking that we were going to have a little bit more of a carefree, more liberatory kind of environment come fall and move back into sort of working back in our office buildings, and yet this little mutation, this changing thing, this changeling continues to affect us, and I feel as though it is as appropriate as ever to continue to go back to our Buddhist principles and our frameworks and our mindfulness practices to kind of help support us and make sense of some of the things that we are, which is change, and how we can sort of ride the waves, as it's been said, as skillfully as possible. And to help us do that today, we have a lovely guest, Lama Justin von Bujas, an American Buddhist teacher and chaplain. He was ordained as a Rinpoche in the Karma Kamsang tradition of the Tibetan Buddhism, by His Eminence. Boy, you're going to have to help me with this one. Goshir Gyaltsab Rinpoche?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. In 2001, and was given the name, is this Rinpoche Dorje Ojer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm doing all right. Justin is passionate about the preservation of the Tantric Buddhist tradition in a way that meets the needs of and simultaneously challenges the modern Western way of life. He is co-founder and a guiding teacher for Bhumisvarsa. Is that right? Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. An experimental Tantric Buddhist Sangha founded with Lama Rod Owens, which is kind of how I think I first heard of you, because I had been studying a little bit with Lama Rod. From 2012 to 17, Justin served as the co-founder, resident Lama, and executive director of New York Serfsu Goshir Dharma Center, and he is presently the first dedicated staff chaplain for the New York City Department of Correction. So he works on Rikers Island, and he's also the author of this beautiful book, which we're going to talk about today, Modern Tantric Buddhism, Embodiment and Authenticity in Dharma Practice. Welcome, Justin. It's so good to see you.
Yeah, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's you know, you're one of those people I've wanted to talk to for a while, because I think you blend what I've been trying to do that I didn't find a lot of when I was starting, and based on your positionality and social location, which I will let you explain for yourself or share if you'd like to share your location, your social location, also your territory and the land you're on. You know, I don't see a lot of people who, at least on first glance, look like you talking about the things that you try to talk about and marrying the kind of Buddhist principles that you do with the way in which we can move into social action. But I'll let you introduce yourself in that way, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no problem. So yeah, you know, my name is Justin von Bujas. I live in South Brooklyn, which is Lenape territory. I self-identify as a straight white male. I think even though that might be how I identify, that's not really how I think of myself so much. If I had to think of myself as anything, it would be some kind of like medieval Indian tantrika trapped in this time. So the book and a lot of the work that I do, it is rooted in this intersection of tantric Buddhist practice and chaplaincy, and then I think also a lot of kind of natural critique, which I think is a healthy thing for practitioners to engage in exploring how is it that I interact with the tradition that I am practicing. What does it mean for me as, for example, somebody in New York City to practice a tradition that developed in anywhere between the 2nd and 8th century India? What does that mean? You know, obviously it doesn't mean I need to dress, in Asian style clothes. It doesn't necessarily mean I need to change my name. It doesn't necessarily mean I need to change my interests or my passions. So I think a lot of my work has been trying to embody and crystallize that ethos in the form that I happen to take in this lifetime. I think, one of the things that I've encountered in my study and practice of Buddhism is that most of my practice and training has happened in Asia, primarily in the Sikkim, the Darjeeling area, and then a few other places. I didn't really have a lot of exposure to the Western Buddhist tradition until I was kind of well steeped in the tradition. And in beginning to interact with and intersect with Western Buddhist traditions and having Burmese Dharma rising here, I began to see a lot of the ways that social oppressions extend into the Buddhist communities, white supremacy, patriarchy, whiteness in general. It really kind of fostered a number of questions for me around what does it mean to become liberated within the context of all of that. And what we do find sometimes in some of our more traditional sanghas here in the West is a denial of that kind of thinking, this kind of belief that looking at social location, looking at systems of oppression, interrogating ourselves in relationship to power, is more of a Western imposition onto Dharma traditions.
Not pure.
Not pure, yeah. And I'll argue the opposite. I'll say that it's an inherent extension of the development of awareness. Mm-hmm. For example, for me, as a cisgender white male, it's incumbent upon me in the development of the relationship to awareness practices to understand my impact as I move through space. Right, to understand what seems to fall in my lap. I'm just blessed with ease when it comes to X, Y, or Z, right? Or that's how it can look, but maybe it's actually a little bit more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And then the beauty of my work with Margaret Owens and Bhumi Sparshan, and just as a very close friend, is working together to confront the tradition itself in the way that it's arisen here, which has been, I think you could say, easily ensconced within a container of whiteness, right? And so what does it mean to confront power? What does it mean to confront assumptions about people? What does it mean to also kind of step into a larger Western indigeneity when it comes to Dharma practice? So when we look at the way that Dharma spread from the Indian subcontinent up into Tibet, around 900, 1000 AD, morphing, becoming Tibetanized, taking on the richness of that culture, there was a lot of appropriation, that happened, by the Tibetans towards the Indian tradition. And then likewise, we find ourselves in a very similar place now where, as Dharma spreads into, in this particular case, the West, how does it change? And, in terms of a sangha like Buddhist Parsha, which is very diverse and kind of is aimed at the creation of a container that really holds diversity and nurtures diversity. How can everybody within that sangha intersect with Dharma practice in a way that allows them to empower themselves and allows the sangha itself to really demonstrate a specific hybridity of tantric practice and then whoever it is that we are and together to become an expression of liberation.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Yeah, thank you for that. And I'll just also say my pronouns are, I used to say they were she, we, us, but they're really like she, our, ours, I guess, really, which I'm kind of picking up actually from someone who else you might know, Joseph Tamori Gibson, because he was sort of, adopting the we, and that's really more of where I'm at with everything, because if we're talking about interbeing and we're talking about interdependence or co-arising or any of these things that we talk about, what are we really talking about? None of us are separate. None of us are static. And therefore, we're all interconnected. Even the ones who, as the great Sharon Salzberg will say, I may not like everyone, but I love everyone in that way. And so, not pushing anything away, not rejecting anything, making space for all of it, or being the space that contains all of it, however you want to say it. So what I hear you saying is, and I'm a straight multi-ethnic woman, also, I should just say for that. And I say straight kind of wincing because I know that's not actually a term that a lot of people like. So I'd say heterosexual, cisgendered. So here's my thing. Now, we could go in a lot of directions with this conversation. But again, not to, back to this sort of interbeing. Like, it's not like my mindfulness practice. I think it was Lama Rod, maybe it was Reverend Angel Kyoto. I don't know, Williams, but like, don't hoard your spiritual practice. I think it was Lama Rod. You're not sitting there to sort of accumulate your jhana states of, epiphany and hold on to this piece of mind. You're here to be able to be, I think, collectively, flexible enough and strong enough to be able to withstand the challenges that are before us, whether they're ancestral challenges, current, present challenges, perhaps anticipatory challenges as it is with the climate and things like that. And so maybe talk a little bit about how this piece of embodied Buddhist practice, embodied tantric practice, and specifically tantric, not Theravadin, not, sort of insight, other kinds of practices, what does that look like in your sangha or in real life? And I don't know. You can start anywhere with that.
Okay. It's a lovely question. Thank you. So within the context of the tantric tradition, a really important element of the practice is a head-on facing or exploration and resting into everything that arises, right? So all emotion, especially those things that are difficult to bear witness to, difficult to experience, perhaps you could say, within our being, death, suffering, violence, things of this nature. And in the tantric tradition, this is one of the reasons why charnel ground imagery is really important. The tantric tradition.
You said imagery, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Visualization, imagery.
Cemeteries, skulls, death. And so the imagery, both in the art and then in visualization, and then in a number of practices where one may visualize offering their body chopped up into pieces to things that scare us, right? To that might, in the form of these practices, might be wrathful deity spirits or you know, local protector beings, but which also, to some degree, also represent our fear, our anxiety, all of the emotion that usually keeps us kind of recoiling, coming back to ourselves. And so, you know, with respect to embodied practice, this leads me like a moth to a flame to places that are hard. So prior to working for the Department of Correction, I was a home hospice chaplain in New York City, and spent time with people who are actively dying, providing support for their family members and loved ones. Before that, as I was training to be a chaplain, most of my training was on locked psych floors and medical ICUs, these kind of really intense visceral places where, in order for me to be present within my practice of Dharma, within my practice of chaplaincy, and being a support for others, I had to be kind of steeped in suffering, loss, anxiety, watching people die, and finding wisdom in that, finding love in that, finding patience in that. And of course, in corrections, I think you could say the kind of overarching additional experience with violence, right? And typically within like the average Buddhist kind of practitioner mind, there tends to be this kind of preferencing of peacefulness, of creating a nice, wholesome, comfortable environment to practice.
Which sounds a lot like whiteness to me in that way.
Totally, totally, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know, my embodiment is really running into the burning building, you know, running into. And so that burning building could be me, you know, the burning building could be spending time with people who are, who have just been assaulted, or people who are traumatized by an intense work environment, traumatized perhaps by what's arising within them. You know, obviously the experience of death, loss, bereavement, grief, and things like that. And what I find is that all of these things become, they can become very profound teachers. And in my experience, they have become actual, you know, gurus or teachers, death in particular. And then, of course, over the past 5 years that I've been with corrections violence, which is a hard thing to connect to. You know, that visceral quality of showing up for somebody who's recovering from assault. And then may have had that experience 10 times over the past year, and they're only 3 years into a 20-year career. And so, you know, kind of journeying with people in within their suffering.
Yeah. I love that, journeying with people within their suffering. Like it's that I'm certified in focusing, which is essentially a tuning into the felt sense in your, you know, sort of your somatic, your embodied kind of, you know, responses. And we talk about keeping it company, whatever the it is, the something company, and how to create an accompaniment. And in mindfulness language, I think, you know, we talk about bearing witness or sort of being the observer or being the knowing. And then there is the known, and you know, the that whole conversation that's often had in these kind of communities around matter and you know, energy and things like that, and how it's not two in those non-dual ways, right? That we're all of that, but that there's this presence, consciousness, this awareness, this space that, you know, this accompaniment, you know, thing that we're always in relationship to something. We don't exist outside of relationship, and yet we are unique. And leaning in toward the hard part, leaning in, they say what we resist persists, and you know, all those things. When we do lean in, I've found as a therapist now, as well as a life coach and a somatic, you know, practitioner, that when we lean in a way that has that friendly attitude or that fearless or courageous attitude, or you have your lineage behind you, your teachers behind you, your other practitioners that are also training as you did for many years behind you or with you, that there is a support there, or resources we might use in a somatic language to help us to do that and know that we feel like we can kind of make it through that. And the more we do that, that we authentically are more embodied and more fearless. Like, it's not a fake thing. You're not just being brave. You actually have the courage.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's more than the courage, right? It ends up leading to authentic wisdom born of experience. And, right. And you don't stress the importance of that enough. But that is the thing that becomes this fuel that allows us to, quote unquote, reinvest in our meditation or to kind of, you know, double down and go a little bit deeper, because we're actually finding, for example, you know, in my experience of hospice, I like to describe it as, you know, it was a journey of me chasing death across New York City for 3 years, just on death's coattails. And watching people die, watching people go through, sometimes amazing transformations at the end of life, and then sometimes, you know, incredibly difficult experiences as if, you know, falling into, a deep dark hole, that the sustained activity of being present provides us with a ground that allows us to develop authentic wisdom in being in relationship to one another, and then also within ourselves and our practice. And that wisdom is what leads us to an experience of certainty. Mm. And that certainty is the thing that keeps us going and allows everything to become incredibly profound. We can just kind of keep going, you know, keep trying. Sometimes it feels like we're treading water and not going anywhere. Sometimes we're really going to these profound places. Mm-hmm. We don't show up, not a lot happens.
Right. And sometimes the showing up is just treading water, steadying. It's not, you know, you're not swimming the English Channel. You're just sort of not drowning, you know.
Or recognizing, like, you know, wow, I'm really overwhelmed right now. You know, I feel like maybe my circuits are fried. I need to step back. I need to care for myself.
I need that advice. That's what I got to do.
It's like, yeah, it's an awesome practice.
Right. It is. I love the nap ministry on Instagram. She's like, you know, preaching rest. And I do love that, which kind of maybe once, you know, is a good segue to pivot to sort of what you mentioned earlier. And I alluded to around whiteness. How do you use your tantric dharma practice and teachings to kind of interrupt whiteness? And maybe the prior question is, how do you understand whiteness as a system of, I don't even want to just say like oppression, but like contrary to the possibility of liberation for anyone.
Sure. So this is a great question. I was talking to somebody about this earlier in the week. For me, whiteness shows up in a number of ways, but one of the most kind of profound ways is the way that we become involved in a discursive assessment of value around everything around us. So like thinking to colonialism, right? Like, you know, early colonists and contemporary colonists now these days too, will assess everything that they experience spatially and relationally in terms of value, and then assess order and meaning and significance based on the order of value. Right? Those things which are valuable to me, I will try and develop relationship to or take, claim, steal. And so the way we do these things in relationship is stealing people's power and stealing people's efficacy, stealing credit. And basically, you know, this practice of bifurcating experience. So we were talking before about this kind of, you know, resting into unity, right, requires us to be able to be open, accessible, compassionate, empathetic, able to experience love. And for me, you know, the experience of whiteness is kind of very anxiety-based, right? It's rooted in making sure I get what I need, my community gets what I need. It has a lot to do with entitlement. But most of it, I kind of experience as an externalization of these drives around a capitalist type of ordering principle that really changes the way we relate to the space around us and, of course, other people.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that's something vague. How does it show up? It shows up in terms of want, wanting things, craving. And then, of course, pushing away that which has no value, no meaning, that which I don't understand, that which seems foreign. So there's this big kind of level of, and whiteness is not just something that only white people,
right.
Cultivate, right? It can be cultivated by anybody. And I think, much like capitalism, these things have a way of creeping into our psyche just by the sheer prevalence of these things in our culture. So that it's hard to remove a capitalist value system from practice. Right? Always needing to go deeper, always needing to produce deeper and deeper states of consciousness.
Well, it's craving for extraction or for, it's another form of greed in that way.
Yeah. And even, for me at least, in my own kind of thought experiments about this, it makes me wonder if even the idea of evolution, spiritual evolution, for example, falls within that rubric as well. Because especially from the tantric ethos, we're already perfected as it is,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the work really is about resting back into that.
Yeah,
letting go.
Yeah, Lama Suryadas talks a lot about that in the Dzogchen practices of just being, just resting, which is a tantric lineage,
exactly.
as I understand it, and that, it's basically like this is it, and so being the seeker, is a way of kind of, the longing and pursuing the longing and the quest for the longing. You're saying, I'm hearing you say, at least I think I'm hearing you say, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is also potentially you've wondered about a form of craving.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's, yeah. I mean, the way, this gets very subtle, the way we even think of the spiritual path is so heavily influenced by that, right? This idea that I start here and then I end up over here, higher, or that even with respect to awakening, what is awakening really? Is it this thing of successive purification of...
Well, let me just pause for one second because I want all the listeners and watchers, viewers, to know that you spent, 7 years? 10 years? 5 years?
Where?
In retreat and monastery.
Between... going back and forth between here and Asia since 1995.
Yeah, so I guess what I'm trying to say is you're saying this from a place of deep practice as a lineage holder, not as somebody who meditates maybe when you feel like it. So anyway, go on.
yeah, absolutely. It's an excellent point. And I will challenge even the person who's just coming to meditation to crack it open, to crack open the experience and really look at, how it is and why it is that we have the assumptions that we have. It's not that, I think the thing is that it, to some extent, it doesn't really have so much to do with the amount of time we put into it. It has to do with how comfortable we can be with being really honest with who we are.
Yeah.
And so I've met people who have been meditating for 30 years prior to my beginning to meditate. And some folks are really stuck in this idea of progress kind of thing. And then there are people who come, Zen mind, beginner's mind, really freshly. They haven't necessarily been stained by these ideas of, the long hard slog of Buddhist practice.
Right.
And they can see things very freshly. And that's really beautiful thing that happens.
Right, right. Yeah, I love that. I think I would put myself more in the latter category, that whole idea of you know, trying to attain certain jhana states never really made sense to me, just in much the same way I never really was that interested in practicing my arpeggios and yet on the piano. But there is something about a different kind of discipline that one can have an intention for and practice on a regular basis that I found I am more attuned to and with in my own practice. So like in the bug, the, you know, like killing bugs in the house, I don't kill bugs in the house the way that I used to. I don't, you know, and that's not, this is a weird example, but it's, I think about that. What does it mean? All the being seen and unseen, you know, there was this little, like, I just felt an itch on my arm and I went out and it was, you couldn't even really see it, but it was clearly some kind of a little caterpillar. And it just, I'm like, oh yeah, that's what that means. And then all the ones, and I could see that, but it was super tiny. And then all of the other beings and I guess what I'm getting at is there is a certain level of awareness around me being with my day-to-day moment-to-moment experience that I have that is part of my practice that isn't just about sitting long retreats, which I've done, but isn't, it's not just about that. But those have been immensely valuable for other things, like knowing that I can tolerate pain in my body when I sit for 14 hours a day and still survive and not feel like I'm going to die just because I'm, you know, in this position. And that can be enlivening.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, actually to the point you're bringing up, like, the, you know, there's a long thread of practice style around a meditation called Mahamudra, which is very similar to Dzogchen, in which one, you'll often find people advising, and these texts kind of go back to about 900 years, advising people to sit for short periods, like 12 minutes, and where it's really about like breaking up the habit rather than like one long grueling session where, you know, your mind goes numb, you know, you find yourself suffering. Sometimes there's more power in really breaking up the kind of our relationship to habit mind in these shorter sessions of 5 minutes.
Right. Or
I once knew somebody who set a timer on their phone just to like ding every hour. And every, no matter where they were, work, subway, walking around, when that ding would go on, they would just check in.
Yeah.
And like, you know, where am I in relationship to, especially like, you know, this idea of like, you know, whiteness being this externalized projection of
valuation. Yeah.
Break it. It's that it's the act of breaking that you know, unexamined habitual pattern that's the most important thing. The long sustaining stuff, and you know, that's useful, but it's sometimes more useful once you've kind of broken up the hard, you know, crusty surface of our habits.
Yeah. It's, you know, the disruption, as they would say in, you know, the disruptors. Yeah, I love that. So let's talk a little bit about the work you're doing maybe now with some of the folks at Rikers Island, because that's really challenging. And also a little bit more about what's in the book for people who might be interested in reading it, other practices. How do you integrate applying these tantric pieces to essentially social justice and equity work in the real world?
Yeah. So, you know, with my work at Rikers, I think you could best sum it up as trying to be a Buddhist presence within this system of intense suffering. And so it's really this practice of showing up. It's a practice of trying to demonstrate or, you know, disrupt the space through demonstrating compassion, empathy, deep listening, awareness practice, and modeling something different, you know? And so that also, that might not actually sound like a lot, but when you, you know, begin working for a paramilitary organization, you know, you find that thinking is very different, relationship to space, relationship to time, relationship to identity is very different. You know, this is a way of my being able to intersect with not only the criminal justice system, but, you know, system of mass incarceration. And model something different. And luckily, I think we could say, to kind of plant some seeds of change, you know, in the spheres in which I work. You know, modern tantric Buddhism is a kind of in-depth exploration of, it's a couple things. I mean, there's a very thin thread of kind of memoir in it, you know, sharing some of the experiences with my teachers. There are elements of looking at what a Vajrayana-based chaplaincy ministry could look like. And so that means, you know, using tantric Buddhist practices as a way of, especially ones focusing on presence, so direct presence and a willingness to kind of sit in the midst of the fire of difficult emotion, of violence, fear, of pain, of loss, sickness. All of these things are very relevant too. I mean, you know, with respect to COVID, the book came out, I guess, maybe 6 months before, you know, COVID hit. And, you know, the really fascinating thing about COVID was that there are a lot of people who maybe previously didn't necessarily have a huge relationship to illness. Then all of a sudden, either they became ill or their friends, family, you know, loved ones came ill. Watching the entire world almost stop, you know, last year in particular. And it's still, I mean, as you said in the beginning, like this is still in process. Huge amounts of death. Actually, I think we were on a panel together around COVID deaths and
Oh, that's right. We were that for the paper for the New York
And so one of the things I do and have been doing since COVID started is blessing the bodies that end up at Hart Island in the city's Potter's Field for COVID deaths. And it's been about 2,700 that I've done since the end of April 2020.
Wow, that's really sacred work.
Yeah, it's very, very sacred, very close to my heart. And just showing up for that much death is, you know, that's kind of, you know, endemic in tantric practice, helping to, you know, guide these beings, console consciousness that's, you know, perhaps disembodied, let these beings that have died know that they're loved, they're seen, their stories, you know, that they're being witnessed at the very least. But then, of course, by something much larger, you know, than all of us.
That makes me cry. Makes me cry. Consoling consciousness disembodied to know that they're loved. I love that.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why it's really important to me too is again, like kind of breaking out of our habit reaction. And you said it, you know, earlier that it's this interbeing, right? This interdependence that when one of us dies or when all of us die, there's still a part of us, a part of our consciousness that is still, you know, interacting to some extent for a certain period of time. And at a time, especially for people in New York City, you know, April 2020, where it felt like we might as well have been living in the time of Black Death. Right?
Yeah.
I live in Bay Ridge, and, you know, it's a pretty, like, chill and easy place. But I remember, sitting one evening on the couch with my wife, and you could hear people screaming outside because they were hearing news about loved ones who had died. And, you know, just for somebody who grew up in the city, like, I love the city, and it's an intense place, and to see it affected that profoundly, and still for us to be on this cusp of who knows what with respect to the Delta variant, kind of, you know, the power of that is it brings us back to the simplicity of our mortality.
Right.
How fragile everything is, how complex we've made everything in our minds, but how this is really about waking up every day and doing the work we do, showing up for others, showing up for ourselves, going to and hopefully doing it again.
Yeah, in that way, that each day is truly a gift and an opportunity, each breath for that matter. And I think that's what's so sad is that, you know, back to sort of what we started with around the whiteness thing, it robs one, I think, often of purpose with the false promise, if you will, of like you say, if I evaluate properly, then I will, as the great Dr. Carol Gilligan says about patriarchy, I will have one step higher up on the hierarchical ladder of what's better. And what's so interesting to me about Buddhism is people kind of get this wrong when they, you know, and it's easy to get it wrong, that they say it's good or bad. It's never been good or bad. It's skillful or unskillful. It's helpful or unhelpful. And I don't, in the sense of like, that thing of like that trying to achieve something going up on that ladder, it's that it's never, you know, I don't see that it's ever particularly enough because it's an infinite ladder. I mean, now we're going to Mars, right?
Mm-hmm. Like white billionaires going to, yeah. I mean. You're good for us to steal from, you know, claim. Yeah, no, I agree 100%. You know, it's vital work. I mean, this is where also like meditation practice, Dharma practice, et cetera, has this kind of terraforming kind of quality where we, as we break up, you know, or disrupt or kill or smash these habits, right? This habitual lens through which we look at things, that becomes palpable experience for other people. And so we've all been, you know, we've all met somebody or a couple of people or a handful of people in our lives, or just being near them feels incredible, right? Mm-hmm. You know, sitting in relationship, watching them smile, watching them be, watching them talk, listening to them, taking in their presence is transformative. And I think, you know, in this way, we tend to forget how impactful we are in our practice. And so even if you feel like you're just starting off, you know, in a practice, that very initial work is so laden with potential benefit that it's precious. It's one of the most sacred things, you know, we can imagine. And that in these times of mass illness, political instability, environmental crisis, and everything else, we need more people who can demonstrate that kind of empathic, passionate receptivity, right? Allowing, it's more than even just, you know, skillful or unskillful. It's that everything's okay. Mm. You know, John, and you find this also, you know, both in the Zen and Mahayana traditions, where everything is fundamentally pure. Everything is, you know, fundamentally liberated. And it doesn't mean, you know, hey, just, you know, let yourself be abused or you know, let systems be destroyed, the environment be destroyed. But what it does mean is that, you know, even in our worst pain, there's purity. You know, there, even in our moments of great personal despair, there's spaciousness.
Yeah, because it's actually what you're feeling in that moment.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the thing for me is we don't like, you know, just because you don't like it, meaning like I like, you know, that idea of like preferences, right? Am I moving towards something, away from something, or I don't care about something? That idea of just because you don't like despair or it feels uncomfortable doesn't mean that it isn't 100% what is there, you know, and for some reason what maybe needs to be there, and that we can be with that, and that the more that we can learn to be with whatever it is, just like we can learn to be with joy. I know people who push away joy.
Yes.
You know, it's that's, joy is uncomfortable for a lot of people. Contentment and happiness is uncomfortable for a lot of people, ironically, because they don't feel as though they're allowed to have it or whatever, or it means that there'll be less joy for others if they have it, or, you know, there's a narrative that they may have that's unique to them that may go along with that. And so actually being able to be with what we are with, knowing that it's not going to last forever, I think can be a great thing. And that is where I think the sitting practice can be helpful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Kind of see it come and go. Well, we have a couple, like one or two more minutes to maybe just kind of wrap up. Are there any more pearls of wisdom or nuggets that you'd like to share with listeners or viewers before we go?
There's in the third portion of modern tantric Buddhism, it's divided into body, speech, and mind. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Is this exploration around learning to look at everything as the teacher, so including our meditation experiences as we sit, in, you know, especially when we're just starting off in meditation practice, it's very easy for us to experience our mind as chaotic and uncomfortable, with thought activity is fast. And the more that we're able to open up to every single experience, whether it's both of us, you know, together in relationship here, or the people who are listening to this, you know, at a later date, or you're meeting at 6 o'clock afterwards, absolutely every moment, every single thing we see, we smell, we taste, we touch, is practice, is a place of practice. All of those things then also subsequently become our teachers, right? So like, dislike, our reactivity, our need for sleep, our, you know, whatever it is that we're feeling we're needing, the way we might feel challenged, and then the way we may feel incredibly resourced are all our teachers. And there's a lot of wisdom in this and a lot of applicability, you know, for myself as a chaplain or a Dharma teacher, but then I'm a parent, and I'm a partner to somebody, I'm a son, I'm a grandchild, you know, we all have these kind of intersecting identities, and learning to understand that we can actually kind of open up to absolutely everything that's available to us. And in the beginning, it might not feel easy to do that, but we can, and I feel like I've been able to do this in my practice. Open it up more and more and more, and everything becomes, to quote a song from, you know, the Tibetan song that's translated in here, everything becomes a treasury of bliss. Mm. Everything becomes a place for us to be, even death, illness, violence, loss, can become a treasury of bliss because it's experience that we're able to have, that when we can put down this labeling and judgment and kind of the neurosis of lightness, we can actually experience things freely in a more unified way. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Lama Justin, I love what you're sharing with us today. The book is Modern Tantric Buddhism, Embodiment and Authenticity in Dharma Practice. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining us on Rerooted today. It's really a pleasure. We could go on, and yet in our delineated world, I have other things, you know, clients and things like that, and I'm sure you have other things that you would need to do too. But I've treasured our time together, and it will live on through the interwebs or however it is.
Yes, thank you so much, Francesca, for having me on. And please take good care of yourself. I love what you do.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Take care.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up now that spring is here, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. So what's the right amount of socializing for you? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's a great way to build relationship skills, figure out your goals, and so much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.